This morning, we turn our attention to our suicide rates. Next month across the country, efforts will focus on awareness and prevention programs. At the table today, Dr. Deborah Gabert. She's with the University of Hawaii John A. Burns School of Medicine, Department of Psychiatry. She's the director of Hawaii's Caring Communities Initiative for Youth Suicide Prevention. Blaine Garcia is a school health educator with the Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center, who's seeing firsthand what is happening out in our community. Mike Durant is president of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and past chair of the Hawaii Council, State Council on Mental Health. He got involved watching his son struggle with mental illness. And joining us by phone is Dr. Michael Rim. He's a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist who's been practicing for 30 years. Prior to working in Maui, Dr. Rim was the clinical director of the only public child, adolescent mental health agency in South Auckland, New Zealand. New Zealand had the highest rate of youth suicide in the developed world at the time. Welcome to you all this morning. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Gabert, why don't we start with you? The statistic of, you know, suicide in the island every 2 days, that just seems so high. What do you know about what's going on across the state?
Yeah, actually, nationally, there has been a trend in increasing suicides. And unfortunately for Hawaii, it means that there's actually probably one occurring a little less than every 2 days now. And that's been in the last 5 years. And I know everybody wants to know why, and I wish we could answer that. We don't know, because it's really a complex issue. What we have seen, at least for our youth, is that it's occurring at younger and younger ages. So what we used to think was kind of an issue of adolescence and something that we were starting to see in high school, we're now seeing in middle school and even younger.
I mean, it is distressing. I saw the numbers during that survey, I think the risk survey for our youth in our schools, and it was very sad to see that so many had said, I think the numbers here, 6,000 had said that they had contemplated suicide and tried.
Yeah, that they're actually making attempts. And that's one of the things that we see here locally, that when people are seriously considering suicide, that they're actually making attempts. So that gap isn't very big. So again, that's something that's concerning to us, and again, that's moving to these younger ages. There are things that we can look for, and I always like to switch it, because when I look at those numbers, people say, oh, this is horrible. And I'm like, I see hope in these numbers. And the reason I see hope in the numbers, for example, is when we look at people that have made attempts, we know that 85% of youth actually tell someone. So to me, that's a hopeful period. So we can look at the number and say, yes, that's a lot. But there's also a lot of people that are telling someone else. Mm-hmm. Likewise, we see that there's a gap between the number that, in terms of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, they actually look at whether you're feeling sad or depressed and whether it's interfering with your activities. That's another point of contact where we can actually intersect and maybe do something about. So to me, the numbers, as difficult as they are, they're also very hopeful.
Okay. And Blaine, can you talk about what we're doing in the schools to reach maybe that group in the middle school
Sure.
Area?
So in the Leeward Public Schools, middles and high schools, we currently have a clinic that we directly see students in the schools. And within this process, our mission is to meet the needs of the students in the community as well. And this has come up as an issue. So we introduce a program called Sources of Strength within the schools. It's a nationally known program, and it was developed primarily to focus on the juvenile system. But then the way that this system was, or this program was developed, was to identify strengths based and what helped these individuals get through their struggles or their hard times, because we can all agree that we do go through tough situations. So it's really an upstream preventative factor approach to sources of strength and strengths based. So we created a program in the schools where we'd meet with youth and try to build leaders and support groups to focus on the sources of strengths and what they identify as strengths. And a lot of these students, we ask them, like, what is some things that they identify as that helps them get through situations? And a lot of them are like, you know, I like to draw, I like to go to the beach, and helping them identify that, you know, that's an actual healthy activity that helps them get through tough situations, and for them to realize that. And then once they actually realize that, then they start naming a lot of other strategies that they actually have with themselves. So for them to recognize that, to empower, embrace it, they can actually help other youth in their social circles.
Right. It's what works for therapy, right?
Correct. And it's kind of like a trickling effect because they're frontline. They know what's going on within their social circles, within their friends, their families. So if we can help them upstream find ways to identify strengths within their families, their social groups, it really has an impact in the community overall.
Okay. And then, Mike, can you talk about what NAMI is doing just to help families in general?
Okay, well, NAMI is a organization that really helps families dealing with people with a serious mental illness. And we have support groups on Oahu, Maui, Big Island, and Kauai. And we also have the family-to-family training sessions. They're a 12-week class that people take, and it teaches them about mental illness, what they're dealing with mental illness. And with mental illness, the risk group for suicide is much, much higher than the general population. So that's part of what they learn. The support groups we have, you know, people come and just tell us what's going on. My wife and I have facilitated a support group for 20 years now, and we've lost some, including our son. You hear a lot about talk about suicide from the people who are the families that are dealing with people with a serious mental illness.
Yes, and before the show, I was just thinking, gosh, I know about a half a dozen people who've lost their children to suicide, and it's just it's heartbreaking, you know. And you want to help them. You want to make them feel better. You want to give them a hug. But, you know, what works?
It's interesting because, we're fine with it, my wife and I. But when I start to talk to somebody who, say, a recent situation, I get very emotional. It brings it all back. The only thing, our advice is, because we're talking about mental illness in our case, our advice is to try keep them into treatment, because when they're not in treatment, their risk is much, much higher. But we also have the problem with a serious mental illness is they don't recognize that they have a problem. They're not aware of it, and they often refuse treatment. So trying to get them into treatment and keep them in treatment is always a real struggle.
Right. Okay. And Dr. Rimna, when you worked in New Zealand, you said that New Zealand had the highest rate of youth suicide at the time. How was that experience?
Well, it was pretty amazing. It was pretty creepy when I first got there. And it's interesting to hear people, their stories and what they're saying and all the efforts that are being placed around focusing on something so powerful and so, you know, hard to manage. But and when I got there, it was kind of very similar to what's happening now. When I left for New Zealand in 1995, you never heard about suicide, really. It wasn't out in the media here that much. And when we got to New Zealand, it was all over the media. And it was like a little mini experience of what appears to be happening now in our country, a sense of desperation, a sense of rising suicide rates, et cetera, et cetera. And I hadn't been aware of that, but there was similar efforts and lots of efforts and attention being placed on doing something, and we were able to kind of capitalize on a couple of things. One, there was a lot of funding that was being placed into mental health services, and two, we were able to take advantage of things that we kind of already know about people in general and what you know, is a regular old part of life that promotes wellness, and that is enhancing the extent to which we could promote engagement with anybody and anything that was related to these children and communities that were in such distress. So we started building a program around that, and we didn't have the same constraints, you know, as we might have in this country, in terms of you know, we were able to see people for a couple hours a day, two, three times a week, rather than send them into the hospital, for example. And we focused our interventions primarily on, we just knew, you know, it's kind of like raising a child or a teenager is kind of like a business when if you think about it. You know, there's mission statements and there's business plans. Of course, these are all unspoken. And there is a job descriptions, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we know that somewhere some of the people that are involved and some of the influences that are involved, and regardless of what the problem is or what caused it, we know that some of those parts, those multiple moving parts of an organization, if we focus on some of them and they get reorganized in some way, it spreads around and it reaches the people that are involved with the child. And one of the things, one of my mentors down there, from the, actually he was in the Ministry of Education, wrote a really good book, actually, called, you know, he is very consistent with, you know, he says the people that are best able to prevent suicide and manage children and teenagers at risk of suicide are the people they involve, they interact with on a daily basis. Now, that may be intimidating for some folks to think about that, but the reality is a lot of our work and efforts were around identifying whoever was out there that could engage, interact with each other in a way that would clearly indicate to the child that, you know, this is just not something we're going to do. does that, and, you know, so there were other components as well, of course, and you know, of course, they had mental illnesses and there were medications involved, but, what I've recently read is that some of the successful suicide prevention programs, intervention programs, focus primarily on simply just stopping the behaviors somehow.
Well, what are you seeing on Maui?
Well,
what's working? Maybe I don't.
Well,
know.
I don't really. You know, it's where, you know, one of the constraints I think that we're under in our country. There's a lot of constraints that, you know, and one of them is just we're just fragmented. You know, we really don't get to interact and work together as a group of adults, you know, professionals and communities, because it's very clear. So I see some things, you know, I'm very hopeful and see some things that are really good, but there's a lot of things I'm not aware of. Because I'm fragmented up here myself in Makaua. I used to work for the Department of Health, and it was really, really exciting. What I see is I see people sometimes come to my office who are at risk, and their prior stories were, you know, unfortunate stories of kind of constraints in terms of just people being, you know, somehow artificially, seemingly fragmented, or little silos, people call them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Dr. Gabert, what can we do to kind of break down those silos and connect people?
Yeah, I mean, I was just listening to what Dr. Grimm was saying, and I think, you know, there's a couple key things that New Zealand was doing and that are being done here locally, and one has to do with networking, both in terms of the social networking, that in terms of how we try to reach kids, and then second, in terms of the networking that needs to take place and the people that are trying to do this work on their behalf, right, and with them, actually, because we're moving more and more towards youth voice. The state is relatively new to the prevention aspects of suicide. It's, you know, it's really only been about 15 years that we've been trying to do that. So I think we're doing a huge amount. We had a statewide coalition, which was the Suicide Prevention Task Force, called Prevent Suicide Hawaii. Our neighbor island said, look, we need to have more local action. So there is actually a Maui County Task Force. There's a Hawaii County Task Force. There's a Kauai County Task Force. And then last, to join an Oahu Task Force, because they kind of do different things. So it's a place for people to come together to plan events and to do different things. Our locally, our primary focus initially was on training And that's still a focus. And then just trying to move out from there, because training in and of itself, it's like a one-time type of thing. So like the support groups, a lot of people actually get involved in suicide prevention efforts after a death. So it's a good way to direct energy. But we need to move more and more towards, particularly for youth, to doing programs in the schools, after-school programs, other places, and even younger. The best suicide prevention intervention that has been done is actually a program called the Good Behavior Game, and it's for preschool children.
Whoa.
We're not doing suicide prevention in preschool yet. So it's, and that's partly, you know, there's always issues, right, in terms of how can you fund that, where can we do that. That's the federal funds for suicide prevention don't allow you to go younger than age 10. And yet our best programs that have been shown 35 years later to say this has a reduction in suicide, this has a reduction in violence, this has a reduction in severity of mental illness, they take place early on in preschool, where we're really talking about how do we relate to each other, what can we do to improve those relations and just treat each other better.
Right. I forget the line about all the important things I learned in kindergarten, right?
Exactly.
And I guess, Blaine, if you could talk about what we're seeing as far as, like, bullying, you know, because the kids' reality is what's going on in the classroom, and how do we manage that?
Yes. To be honest, I think the biggest monster is everything with social media nowadays and what's being posted on social media and how that really... It's like a wildfire and how that spreads. And if certain situations happen, you know, like we have bullying situations, everyone wants to film it instead of and being a bystander, and they want to film it and they want to post it instead of actually reach out and help the individual that's getting bullied. So that's just like a little example I could use. It happens. Schools are getting better at addressing bullying situations. For example, this starting school year, a lot of the schools started something different this year where they would do a lot of team bonding for the new incoming students. So a lot of the students had a lot of, it was like a team bonding orientation for the first week of school. Instead of having instruction, did a lot of activities outside in the field where it would just be simply team bonding, building leadership for all types of students that come from different walks of life. I think that having that initial approach is really a good way to introduce everybody that's coming from different communities, that's coming to this middle school or this high school. Mm-hmm. And I think that sets a good culture to start the school year off. Regardless, situations still may happen. But we also have a lot of support systems in the schools where we do train the staff to understand bullying situations, how to cope with those things, how to work with students on the strengths-based factors that we do with our Sources of Strength program, Inspiring Hope. So there's a lot of efforts in the schools. There's also a lot of leadership programs where students actually are good at and being more open to, I guess, reporting it versus holding everything
in. Keeping it in.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think the culture is definitely slightly shifting in that direction where students feel more open to actually share and not feel that there's going to be retaliation that's going to happen in the end.
So we're doing this show in advance of Suicide Prevention Month. And there are going to be a number of activities going on in the community. I know, Nami, you folks do the walk, I think. Talk about what other ways we can connect as a community.
Yeah, actually, the Nami Walk is our major fundraiser, but it's also, you know, a really good way to raise awareness of mental illness in the community. Last year, we had about 1,000 walkers, and we hope to even beat that this year. Our son's name was Jay, and our team is called the Jaywalkers. We have one of my, you know, some way of honoring him. But it really is a good event, and, you know, small contributions, large contributions, but it's really our major fundraiser. And we're a very small organization. You know, we just have one part-time executive director and a part-time program manager. So a very small budget, we try to do a lot. We have over 200 volunteers, all the support groups and all the education classes are all done by volunteers. Nobody gets paid other than the executive director and the program manager. So we involve a lot of people in the community, And this year, I think the co-chairs are going to be Josh Green and Chief Ballard. So they know how important trying to deal with mental illness is in the community.
And, Dr. Gabert, talk about maybe what you know that might be happening.
Yeah, so the NAMI Walk, I believe, is in October.
October 12th.
And the Out of Darkness Walk, which is a suicide prevention awareness walk, is taking place across the state. So they're on each of the islands. I do know. So they're Saturdays. And I think the 7th on Kauai, and then the next week is on Oahu, and then the following week is on Maui, I believe. But I would go to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Hawaii chapter's website to confirm the dates on the neighbor islands in particular. We also have proclamation signing by the governor and the mayor to declare Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. They have trainings, so people that are interested in finding more about what they can do, if they just want to be made more aware of what the symptoms are, they can sign up for trainings for that. There's also people that want to know maybe how to deal more with a crisis. There's separate, longer trainings for that type of thing. So we do have trainings going on across the state. The Department of Health's injury prevention website has all of that listed, or will be listed soon if it's not up already. I don't think it's up just yet. Really, it's just a great time to get involved in suicide prevention. It's not the only time. So if your September's booked up, just look for another month. That's why it's great that NAMI has something coming up in October. But there is always something going on, and we do trainings all year round. And you can ask to schedule trainings as well. So definitely there's ways to get involved. There's also monthly task force meetings, as I mentioned, on Oahu, as well as on our neighbor islands, and those two are available.
Okay, well, if you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about mental health and suicide. You can join the discussion by calling 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We do have a call coming in. Michelle from Kaneohe, what's on your mind?
Aloha. First off, I am so sorry for your loss. You know, the fact of losing a child is just horrendous. I lost my dad to suicide when he was 53 and I was 14. And I just wanted to remind folks out there that suicide is a lifelong legacy. It's like a scab that never completely heals. And I came close some years ago, and thank goodness I got help. And my biggest thought was I wouldn't want to leave that legacy for my son. So anyway, I just wanted to thank you folks for the work that you're doing out there. And if we can prevent suicide, any age, any level, that's doing the work of angels. So I just wanted to thank you.
Well, thank you, Michelle, for calling in and sharing that story. Dr. Rim, you mentioned you'd worked with the health department. What do you take from that experience and what you saw was happening out in the community?
Well, it was wonderful efforts to kind of coordinate all the influences that were impacting children and teenagers, and got a little complex at times because, you know, but it was a really wonderful effort on behalf of the Department of Health, Department of Education. And the idea was again trying to coordinate a bunch of services or influences or people with the purpose of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. And those efforts were pretty impressive, and it can get a little bit difficult for a lot of reasons, but lots of challenges. And we here on Maui managed about 150 students that were at high risk of being placed out of their homes, and they have so. But you know, as good as it was, there were just a lot. There were also just a lot of pieces, a lot of moving parts. You know, sometimes it would seem like there's too many. You know, with all people intending, with all really good intentions, it was. you know, sometimes the target of change or the primary area of change that's required to influence is not necessarily so complicated. It's just finding it, you know. So, but it was certainly it was the best thing that I've come across, you know, in organized program of that sort. But I've been away from it for about 9 years or so. And one thing that I did want to, there's two things I wanted to add. One is that for me it would seem it was quite important and revealing and empowering and hopeful, is that one of the things that we saw in New Zealand, for example, and we still see it here all the time, is that when the young people see us focusing on stabilizing and comforting and supporting the grown-ups, whoever they are, because it's the most undervalued industry or institution in the world. It's a kind of a tragedy, a crisis of how little emphasis is placed on the value of being in charge of children. So that we learned that the grown-ups, as they should be, were more desperate than the children. But they were not necessarily, you know, culturally it wasn't really appropriate for them to be the ones who were screaming and yelling, or so to speak. So when we emphasized stabilizing or looking, just knowing somewhere with their grown-ups, families, in-laws, aunts, uncles, teachers, therapists, when the children and teenagers noticed us focusing on them, and it was really difficult because these grown-ups had been doing what they've been doing for a long time, for better and for worse. And the children and teenagers really, really got better quickly, and they were really relieved, as were the parents. So anything that promotes engagement, you know, from one point of view, it's a very, very complex, you know, start to finish, you know, the experience, you know, and everything that influences an actual completed suicide is a complex experience that we'll never quite understand as well as we'd like to. You know, if we have pneumonia, we can understand that pretty easily. There's really only a two or three moving parts we need to pay attention to, and it's pretty reliable. If we do, 95% of people will get better. So the complexities of everything that goes in from the start of whatever it is to a completed suicide is very, very complex. And fortunately, the end result, you know, is it's still considered a very rare event from a statistical point of view. Now, one suicide is a tragedy and should never happen. So, When we were down there in New Zealand and Australia, I was involved quite a bit with lots of things, and there was a lot of emphasis on trying to come up with prevention programs. And then, you know, I don't know how they played out. I've done some research a little bit and seen some of the things, but I do remember there was a controversy. Well, you know, do we promote and talk about at the actual suicide, or do we want to promote connection, engagement, resilience, and wellness? And I think Dr. Gebert was talking about with the preschool kid, I mean, that would certainly be something like that, you know. So, because it is, it's. I'm not quite sure what to make of the fact that it's spoken about so much. There were media guidelines in New Zealand, you know, and Australia that, you know, we don't really talk about, we don't even declare a suicide until at least a year, and then we're supposed to kind of put it on the back pages because it's still pretty scary, and the contagion, the copycat component is something that may actually be happening in ways that we're not aware, because it's, my goodness, there's a TV show about it. I mean, that's pretty shocking, to be honest.
Well, I do want to talk
I just wanted to say that you know, just promoting engagement, and every child wants to be engaged with parent figures,
right?
Provided those parent figures are up and running, regardless of what people say.
Well, we have to take a break now. Yeah. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Our topic today, preventing suicide in the islands. You can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break.
One ocean, one people, one canoe. HPR invites the Kauai community to a screening of Moana Nui A Kea, the documentary of Hokulea's landmark worldwide voyage, and a Q&A with Hokulea crew members. Saturday, August 31st at Kauai Community College's Performing Arts Center. Reserve your spot at hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Dawson.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Jean Houston, author of The Wizard of Us. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about transformational lessons from Oz. Please join me.
Sunday morning at 11.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Island Insurance, and Sacred Hearts Academy.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about mental health and suicide. We do have a call coming in from the Big Island, Jim from Hilo. Do you have a question?
Yes. I'm actually a mental health patient and dealt with suicidality a lot myself. I also worked in the mental health field in California for the last 2 years. Engagement, yes, definitely. You need to get people's mind off of themselves and on to a higher purpose. I notice when I'm suicidal, I'm focusing on myself and I'm not thinking of anybody else. That's the time I need to focus outward and find my purpose. And if you just talk to people that are going through that, oftentimes, even though you can't really fix the problem, it just makes them feel better that somebody's listening, talking to them. Also, if you've heard of the ACE study, ACE's Adverse Childhood Experience, it might need to be modified for a child state, but maybe have that in the school sometime. And just, it might be a way to screen kids that are, you know, have the potential to suicide out. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Jim. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, certainly. There's actually so much that goes into suicide, right, in terms of the complexity, which we've already talked a little bit about. And adverse childhood events are things that have been coming up. It's actually an older study, but recently it's receiving more and more attention. And our pediatricians are starting to look at those more routinely and collecting that information all the way through. So it comes up for adult suicidality, that experience is related, but also for children. So they're traumas that occur, so it could be child abuse, right? I mean, there's many, many things that could be considered in there. In terms of what we know and in terms of predicting suicide, that does come up as one of the concerns. It's considered a loss. So anytime you've had a trauma, that's some sort of loss, and loss is our most important predictor right now. So you could have other forms of loss. They could be related to the loss. A death of a family member, that could be a loss as well. You can have loss related to moving, right, where you're trying to relocate and move, which is why, for instance, our military families are at higher risk because we have those kinds of moves, and that's another form of loss. It could be, again, a lot of the bullying, a lot of it occurs between friends, the social isolation that occurs where once your best friend is now your enemy. And that can be a huge, huge loss. So we look at loss in that risk area. And if you have a lot of risks, then, you know, that could actually be a warning sign.
And Blaine, you work in the schools. Are you hearing a lot of this trauma from the children?
Yes. Directly. And that, and it's because everyone comes from different family dynamics, and there's a lot of compounding factors that these students are dealing with at home, in their environment, coming from different communities, moving to the community. So I think a lot of times, in the good efforts that we do in the school-based health centers that WANACOMP has partnered with the DOE system and we built clinics in, is we do initial screeners that we actually, it's like a simple screener, and we catch students, and then that opens up the conversation with the providers to actually dive into this and then get them connected to our clinical psychologists that we provide for them on the campus. And really having that support system, and then from the clinical psychologist perspective, then they kind of bring them into our support social strength group. So it's a really like a team effort that we work within the schools. And then if anything comes up within the DOE side and the counselor side that comes out for conversation, they actually do refer to us as well. So we're really like active in the community, directly in the school, meeting them frontline where the students are.
Okay, we have another call coming in. Gary from Kaneohe, you're on the line.
Yeah, hi. My experience is more with an adult. I know you guys are talking about juveniles a lot, but I had a friend that, you know, committed suicide a few years ago, and I just would like to kind of explain what we experienced, at, you know, some of his friends, because he was suffering from depression, anxiety, panic attacks, had been taking different types of medication and all that. But in the last few months of his life, it's like he would always call upon myself and other friends and relatives to spend some time with him, and he would have a really hard time being alone. It was pretty much daily and hourly that he needed someone to be around. He even had a dog that, you know, he was sort of dependent upon to kind of keep himself under control. But we looked around at the time at Kahimahala and some other treatment centers, and it seemed like every time we check on something, there was some sort of qualification that he would not meet. You know, he's taking a particular medication, can't go there. We go to Kahimahala, he hears people kind of acting out, and he won't go there. He refuses to go there. But to me, at least in this case with an adult, my perception, and I wrote an essay about this, was that people like him need the human touch. They really, I guess, for lack of a better term, if they don't have someone around with them, then they're going to go ahead and do, you know, the deed, which is what he did. And from what I could tell from what we experienced in trying to find him help, because his doctors, his psychiatrists and psychologists said there used to be some, you know, residential types of care for people like him, but because of the way the rules have evolved, it's very difficult for some people to find, you know, a place. And obviously, I think cost is a huge impediment for people like him, because the cost of having the human touch is going to be high. So I really think that what's missing in our state, and probably in general, is some kind of, you know, residential facility that allows, you know, more people contact and someone around. And I think that the problem is, at least to me, there are a lot of people in the community who are probably willing and able to provide volunteer services to be kind of just someone to talk to, like one of your previous callers mentioned, because that's what some of these people need. There are people who are badly in need of probably providing companionship and are willing to do it without having to charge anyone. And there are people like my friend who needed someone like that. And it seems like, you know, if there was some sort of institute, you know, some sort of facility that was set up so that these two parties could kind of support each other in the way that they can.
Well, it sounded like you folks realized that your friend was reaching out and you tried to get him help in different ways. So we appreciate you sharing that story. Is there something that we should talk about, like as far as the resources in the community?
Yeah, I do want to touch on first the talking about listening, because that is something that everybody's capable of doing, and taking that time to, you know, just really sit down and have that conversation, as it were, that we for example, Mental Health of America has a program that they teach for kids, and they actually changed the name of it from Stopping Suicide to Ho'olohopono, which means to listen, because it is the active thing that we can take part in, and that it helps. That said, for some people, that's not enough, even if even if everybody needs that, some people need more than that. We, you know, you talked about treatment in terms of what the facility is. We do want people to be in the least restrictive environment. That's considered the best for healing. But there are times where people need to be either institutionalized in a residential facility. And there are minimal locations here on island. I think we want people to recognize the signs because they are reaching out, particularly for kids, maybe not so much for adults, but maybe young adults as well. People will say they're only kidding, so they'll mention they're feeling suicidal, and then they'll say, oh, no, I'm just joking. Mm-hmm. We want anytime anyone's saying it, that you just have to take it seriously. And then mm-hmm. it's hard when somebody has a serious mental illness where they're mentioning it all the time. Mm-hmm. We still need to take it seriously every time because mm-hmm. we don't know yes. whether that's the time that we need to take that seriously.
And Mike Durant, can you share anything, you know, personally that you had with your son?
Well, he did really kind of have a triggering event. He had other attempts, but this one, he actually had a relationship that was working out pretty well, and he was engaged to be married, and had a very big blow up, and really that kind of triggered it. I think that in his case, you know, that he was because he wasn't really taking his medication as he should have, that led to the blow up, the bad situation, and he just wasn't something he can handle. Talking about the facilities, he had been hospitalized somewhat recently, and the stays tend to be short for hospitalization. And then there's not usually a next step. He was living independently, so he'd come out of the hospital and go back to where he was staying. You usually want something a little more supportive environment to try to get him on the medication. Another thing that's kind of interesting, it was 10 years ago when he died, but the medications were just coming out as injectables at that mm-hmm. time. And the one that worked quite well for him had just come out like 3 months ago. And I talked to him about it, you know, can try this injectable, and no, not a chance, and he wouldn't even consider it. I really think if he could have got him on the injectable, he'd probably still be alive today. And we have people that come to our support group over and over again. Once we find out that they've got their loved one on the injectables, you know, boy, thank goodness for that. Because when you have first off, you're talking about normally pills you have to take a daily basis, and you have to you can't be sure they actually take it, right? But when you got the injectables, it's there, and it's good for 2, 3, 4 weeks, depending on how it goes. So the injectables have made a big difference with the mental health.
Right, because sometimes it's with a chemical imbalance, mm-hmm. I guess, that some folks are dealing with.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Dr. Rimk, talk about what you think, mm-hmm. what we could do to help make our young people mm-hmm. more resilient.
Well, I think for them to watch us make ourselves more resilient, to be mm-hmm. honest, I think that our culture is overwhelmed from, our children are fairly resilient. I think it's our culture that has disengaged us from them much too much, and we rely on them too much. So let me reference a textbook I came upon about 2 or 3 years ago, which anybody who deals with children ought to know about, and it's called The Collapse of Parenting: How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Mm-hmm. So there's been a trend, and so without summarizing the whole book, there's just been multiple trends from multiple socioeconomic, market, political, all kinds of forces out there whereby the following seems to have happened, that there's been a transfer of authority of grown-ups much more so to children and adolescents than I think has ever been before, whereby what I learned is that parents are much more afraid of their children than the children are of the authority of the grown-ups a lot. We tend to overly rely on children and teenagers to make really, really difficult choices that we really ought to be the ones who know how to guide them. And so the children, I think what they need to see is that we have confidence in engagement and connection. I think it's very promising that anyone listening sees that there's four or five of us who are kind of like taking care of each other a little bit, you know? We feel for each other, we feel his pain, and as we all should. And people should know that we can all handle that and do something the best we can. And I think come together as you know, there's a lot that we're learning about new things. I mean, Dr. Gebert was talking about the trauma, adverse life events, and, you know, 40 to 50% of people with psychiatric diagnoses, had severe, complex, repeated trauma that people didn't know about. I mean, trauma is very, very complex, and we're learning much more about it, much more about it. And, you know, descriptions of trauma help understand why someone would go down a path of self-harm and suicide more than what appears to be the current descriptions of psychiatric diagnoses, which are trying as hard as they can to clarify, you know, what are the causes of human distress? How do we actually clarify it? And how do we identify what to do about a specific situation and a particular person's human distress? And we're learning that that some of the constraints in our culture have led us to try to have to overly manualize things and overly describe things.
Well, Dr. Gabbert, what do you think?
Would like to add to that.
Okay, go ahead.
So, like, working with the youth for fun in my community perspective, specifically, and one of my biggest missions growing up in Waianae and seeing all those changes from the years and realizing that healthcare and education growing up there wasn't a priority, I think it's really important to really empower the OPO or the next generation in the community, because they do have a voice and they want to be heard. And I find that a really strong protective factor from the work that we do in the community, coming back and working with this new generation of OPO, because they actually really find that leadership role in the community and their advocacy, pushing forward to make change in the community, whatever health issue they may be identifying. Mental health specifically is actually one of the biggest things that they push for, and like really empowering them to have that leadership role, I think it's really a strong protective factor that I've seen personally. And it's really, ideally, it's going to start taking their generation to start making change for the next generation to follow and to follow after that. So a good example is having the Youth Summit and having these youth come from the communities to advocate for bills to be pushed forward so that way we can get funding to support more of these issues in our communities. And I've really seen that change starting to happen within these generations of youth that are coming in our communities and really holding tight to the culture that has been shifted, as Dr. Rumi said, in the community. So I think it's really a good movement that we've been seeing forefront working with the youth in the communities.
So it's basically helping them build those skills,
definitely.
I guess, to empower themselves. Mm-hmm. That's how we built a more resilient community.
And ideally, they definitely have those skills. It's just more so helping them build that confidence to realize that they actually have it within themselves to move forward and that they have the capabilities of it, because they do come from families that they don't have that adult support system, so they don't feel like they have that leadership role where they can take, but they actually do have it. So really not enforcing it, but empowering them to realize that they do have it.
Any other thoughts anyone wants to add about resiliency?
Well, just real quick, it's actually, you know, wonderful to empower young people and teenagers to use their voices, and their voices, they have so much to say, and we want to encourage leadership. However, we want to be careful and cautious about fundamental things. One, if they don't have adults in their lives that they can count on, if we find some, we know, whether it's their parents or not, we just know the outcomes will be better, and there's lots of studies that support that, number one. Number two, we want to be careful about what it is we ask young people and teenagers to be leaders of. leaders of student councils, leaders of debate clubs, you know, leaders of sports teams or National Honor Society. You know, that's kind of developmentally appropriate leadership within our culture. You know, being the leader of, you know, input to mental health and suicide prevention, that's a little much, you think. It's how do you know about those things, you know?
Okay, well,
we want to make sure that we're divvying out these responsibilities.
Right, not asking too much.
I want to respectfully disagree to that one because we are working well with youth to become leaders in prevention, particularly as you focus on the strengths. And that is who youth are turning to when they're reaching out to tell somebody that they're suicidal. That can only be done if they trust adults, and so working on the adults is super important.
Okay. We've got about a minute left. Mike Durant, you want to add anything?
I just want to say thanks for having me on the show, and the NAMI walk is October 12th. It's namihawaii.org. NAMI works just with families and friends of people with serious mental illness. There's another organization, United Self-Help, that works with people who actually have the illness.
All right. Thank you so much. We would like to thank all of our guests, Mike Durant, president of NAMI, Blaine Garcia of the Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center, Dr. Deborah Gabert, director of Hawaii's Caring Communities Initiative for Youth Suicide Prevention, and Dr. Michael Rim, psychiatrist based on Maui. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. And if your call didn't make it on the air, you can still contact the talkback line and leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. Send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday for more of the Conversation.